Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Not long ago, the only resource for uncovering our familial pasts was to consult libraries and archives, combing old newspapers for birth announcements and obituaries. These days, many people are turning to websites like Ancestry and 23andMe, taking DNA tests to learn more about their ancestors and where they came from, often discovering long-buried secrets and long-lost relatives in the process. But for some, the answers to these questions exist not in archives or in their DNA, but within a suitcase. When writer Danielle Geller's estranged mother passed away, she left behind just 8 suitcases of belongings, cataloging her wayward spirit, moving between boyfriends, states, and jobs, at times experiencing homelessness. In her debut memoir, Dog Flowers, Geller, trained as an archivist, consolidates the most important artifacts from the collection, never-before-seen photographs, documents, letters, and diaries, piecing together a portrait of the mother she grew up without, and reconnecting with her Navajo heritage in the process. Today on the New Books Network, join us as we sit down to chat with Danielle Geller about her striking family memoir, Dog Flowers, available now from One World. Danielle, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So Dog Flowers begins with the unexpected passing of your mother, a woman from whom you were estranged. Can you tell us a little bit about your mom as you knew her growing up and her presence in your and your sister's lives?
Yeah, so we lived with my mom, or my mom lived with us, until I was about 4 years old. And then after that point, I was with my dad and some of his girlfriends for a little while. And then my grandma adopted me and my sister when I was 5. I was in kindergarten. It was like the end of my kindergarten year. And at that point, you know, my mom would come visit us for holidays and for like birthdays, or we'd like go and see her at work. I remember her being a waitress at a bagel shop, and we would go to the bagel shop and I'd get like a chocolate chip bagel, and my sister would get like, I forget what my sister got. And we'd just like sit in the restaurant and like eat our bagels and like hang out with our mom. But my memories of her when I was younger, like that those times that we were together, is that she was just really fun. Like she was funny and she was always laughing. And, you know, like when we weren't with her, we wanted to be with her. And when it was time for her to leave, it was always this like heartbreaking, like, don't leave, stay, like sleep on the couch, like, you know, like not wanting that time to be over. And so like, those are my memories of my mother. But then layered on top of that was this narrative that especially came from my grandma, who was my dad's mom, where, you know, our mom was just boy crazy and she drank too much and she was lazy and she didn't want to work and she lived off her boyfriends. And, you know, like, and I would have, I have these memories of like, these crazy, inappropriate stories that she would tell us about, like the guys that my mom was sleeping with and like her cheating on my dad and finding her naked. And it's like, we were just kids, you know, but there was very little filter when it came to the kinds of conversations that my grandma and my dad would have with us when we were growing up. And so I had like these memories of my mom and who she was, and how fun she was and how much we loved her. But then there was also like this weight of who we were told that she was. And anytime we did something that was wrong or that they didn't agree with, it would always be like, well, you're just like your mother, or like you get that from your mom. And so just like over the years, like anything that felt like it didn't fit into who they wanted us to be, it's like, oh, well, that came from your mother. Mm.
So early on in the memoir, you describe the 8 suitcases of belongings that your mother left behind. So I'm curious, from the portrait that you're giving us of your mother, what are some of the things that you found in her suitcases? And how did you use these objects as evidence to piece together a portrait of a life that you hadn't known through your own young experiences with your mother, and then also your grandmother's version of the story?
Yeah, well, I mean, there were a lot of things in those suitcases. A lot of them were clothes. Some of them were funny. You know, like, I remember there was this one, like, it was this crushed turquoise green blue velour shirt that had like this white fringe in this V shape across the chest. It was very 80s. It was very like 80s Western. My mom was like really into country music, which I think is like a common thing where she's from. And just like knowing what my aunties listen to, and the music that's always playing on the Navajo radio station, KTNN. But yeah, so some of it was just like, looking into her style, the things that I recognized, the things that I didn't like. And then there were a lot of photographs. And I think the photographs were some of the places where I could really see a little bit into her life. And some of them I had copies of, you know, ones of, and some of them I didn't. And she had given me a big, when she'd come to visit us when I was in the 8th grade, she'd given us a big stack of photos from her childhood that she had had, but we only got some of them. We didn't get all of the photographs from her childhood. And so, you know, there were like negative packages of photos in there where I was suddenly seeing these pictures from childhood that I had never seen before, and seeing into especially like her life with my dad when the two of them were raising me and my sister. But another section or a big number of the photographs were ones that she'd taken when she was like hanging out in bars with her friends. And so there were a lot of people that I didn't recognize. And at first it felt like a confirmation of the things that my grandmother had told me, that like my mom was boy crazy. You know, she's like sitting in the lap of like guys I don't recognize and like having a really good time in a bar. And it was like, oh, so there's a part of you or a part of me at least. It's like, so you didn't want to be in my life. You didn't want to like take care of me and my sister, or like see us, because you wanted to be out partying in bars all the time, is like what that initial like feeling of rejection is and abandonment, which is something that like I've come to learn. Children of alcoholics and adult children of alcoholics, like we struggle constantly with those feelings of abandonment. It's hard to look past that like initial sharp feeling of hurt, like that feeling that, and because you internalize it and you turn it around, you're like, what about me? Like, wasn't good enough? Like, why didn't she want to be in my life? But when you start pushing past that, and when I like moved past some of those photos, and I started digging into her letters between her and her family, and reading through her diaries, and the diaries were just kept in these appointment books. So there weren't very many lines. There wasn't a lot of space or time for her to really elaborate what was going on every day. But that's when I started to realize, you know, like, oh man, like in the 90s, when I was just a kid, like running around with my friends in the grass, like she lost her mom, she lost her dad, she lost her brother. She was like a woman who was grieving and surrounded by people who likely weren't very supportive. Like she was constantly taking care of other people. And there was just a lot going in her life that I didn't have access to or understand. And once I did, I started to realize that, you know, like she didn't have the capacity to be there in the way that she needed or wanted to. And it's likely that she felt like it was better for her to stay away and that my grandma was taking care of us and maybe she just shouldn't interfere.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm really glad that you bring up the photographs, the documents and letters, the excerpts from your mother's diary, because these are elements of the text that are not just written about, but are fully incorporated into Dog Flowers. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what is a photolingual memoir, and if you could talk just a little bit more about the ways that your book intersects with archival research and preservation.
Yeah. So photolingual was something that one of she was an editorial assistant when I had just turned in my manuscript, and she was like writing the jacket copy and like came up with this. I was like, oh man, I love that. I love that word. And, or like that combination of words. And I didn't really think about like why too much. But like now, like thinking about what about photolingual memoir do I really connect with or like feel like represents this book? I think that photographs have their own language, and that language isn't the spoken or the written word. That language is light and color, and like these visual qualities that we still, like our brains still like piece into a narrative. And there are a lot of writers that talk about, that use the language of photography to talk about writing. It's partly like why we talk about like framing. But it's not even, you know, thinking about like those technical terms about the way we talk about photography and the way that a photograph is like staged or framed or the aperture or the, you know, the focus, mm-hmm. or all of those things. It really is about, there were a couple of photographs that my mother took, and one of them I included, and it's just a picture of a shadow in the dirt, and it's not accidental. You know, like I've taken photographs like that before, and it's one of those moments where I really recognized something of myself in my mother that was hard to put into words. And throughout the book, I was encountering it. It was trying to look at the world the way that she was looking at it so that I could really understand or try to understand the decisions that she made and why she made them and strip myself out of the equation as much as I could. And I think that intersects too with, the way that archives and research and preservation, like those things enter into the book. I got a master's in library and information science, and I was focusing in archival management. And when my mother passed away, I was actually in my last semester of graduate school, and I was doing all these different internships, and I was working in all these different archives and libraries around like the greater Boston area. And so when she died and I got this box or this suitcase of stuff, like my first instinct was to like organize it into like manila folders and label them and like put them in chronological order. Because I was trying to detach myself from like the emotional component in a way. I really was just trying to be like, well, here's this stuff and like I have to deal with it. And so how do I like put it somewhere? Until like my sister Eileen, she wasn't able to make it down to Florida when my mom was in the hospital. And then she was supposed to come to Boston and we were going to go through her things together. And then that trip kept getting delayed and delayed and delayed. And so that idea that of preservation, it felt like I had to keep it in the state that it was in for as long as possible, until my sister could be there with me to go through it. And for a while, that meant just leaving it in a suitcase in my living room. And then my roommate were like, you got to do something. We're like, you can't just sit here in the living room forever. and they didn't use words. They just kept like moving it out of the way. But yeah, so that was initially how like that thread of like the archive came in, because like it was my professional training. It was what I thought I was going to be doing with my life. And then those questions of like when I started processing it in the archival sense, I was like, this isn't a collection that would end up in some kind of institutional archive somewhere. It's not something that would typically be collected. Like, what did my mother do or accomplish that would make this hold some kind of value to current or like, you know, like how archives and museums and historical societies, how they make decisions about what they collect, it's very political. It's very, and often it's late, and they realize too late what communities, what people they should have been collecting or like collecting records from. And so now you see a lot of archives doing projects where they're going back and trying to find collections from people from different like minority communities, or you have like a bunch of like gender and sexuality archives starting up, like especially community archives. You know, there are the way that women are represented in the archive has changed. And so that was always in the back of my mind too. Like those questions of, you know, like, what am I doing this for? Who am I saving these things for? Like, am I going to have kids? Am I saving it for my sister's kids? Like, what are my goals? What am I doing and why? And those questions kind of guided me through some parts of the book as well.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So many of the chapter titles and the footnotes are actually comprised of lines from your mother's diary, of which you write, quote, I had hoped to find more heartfelt expressions of our mother's regrets, but I was forced to look for those sentiments between the written lines. So my question now is, what was the process of incorporating these lines into the text for you? And what are some of the things that you learned about your mother through these sparse lines?
Actually, I think I'd like to read a short excerpt from the book. And this comes from a chapter. What is it called? I think it's called Pretty Little Thing. Pretty Little Thing. And yeah, I'll just read it and then I'll talk about it. But the way that it works is there are footnotes throughout the book. And it's often in those footnotes where I am writing out some of those lines from my mother's diary. The last time I talked to my mother, it was November. The sky cold, the trees bare. She was crying. She struggled to tell me that she found Ron, her ex-husband and sometimes boyfriend, dead. He had hung himself in the back of their bedroom door. And here is a footnote. I find no record of that day in my mother's diaries. At the beginning of November, she mentions a yard sale with Ron. On November 14, 2012, running out of money, call back to unemployment to make sure everything done. Ron and I are sick. 4 beers left, so Ron let me drink it. On November 21, moving freezer food and canned goods out of house. On November 30, went to police department to get report of death for Ron. So, you know, this person, her ex-husband, I had met him once and I didn't really know him, but they were together for, I'd say like 10 years on and off. And when he died, you know, maybe I'll just read like the section that immediately follows that footnote too.
Sure.
When she calls me, like, this is the conversation that we have about it. I stared at the sidewalk dotted with dirt-encrusted gum. In one moment, I considered asking my mother to come stay with me in Boston, and in the next, anger chased the thought away. My mother only ever called me when she felt guilty about the distance between us, only ever called me when she needed reassurance, forgiveness. I told her I was sorry, an apology as hollow as her love felt to me. "It's okay, baby," she said, her voice suddenly dry. "Mommy's friends are taking good care of me." "That's good," I said. She told me she was back with Dale. He was grilling in their backyard. She told me they had a garden and they were trying to grow tomatoes and corn and beans. I responded in single syllables. She told me she loved me, then hung up. And so, you know, like that conversation that we had after, like, it would be so traumatic, like finding this person that you loved in your bedroom. But we didn't really, you know, we weren't in a position where we could really have those conversations with one another. And then, you know, she tells me like her friends are taking care of her, that she's okay, that she's with her, like Dale was her other boyfriend, that she sort of like went back and forth between Dale and Ron. And I'm like, okay, great. That sounds great. Like you're fine. And it isn't until after she passed away that I realized that she wasn't. She, after Ron died, she stayed with Dale for a little bit and then she was homeless. She was living in a park in Lake Worth before she passed away. And so like going back here in this moment and like going into her diaries, you find sort of like, she's not talking about what she's feeling. She's not reconciling with his death in any way. She's talking about going to a yard sale, and then like they're running out of money, and that was ultimately why he ended his life, was because he had a problem with gambling and was in debt and like didn't know what to do about it. And so you see some of that like running up to it where they're out of money and they're rationing beer, and you know, like she has to like clean his room. She's like moving freezer food and canned goods out of his house. She's like filing a report of death for him. But like it's in sort of like the absence of her emotionally like trying to like reconcile with this or deal with it, or even, you know, in the privacy of her own diary, write out some of what she's feeling about this loss. Like she didn't have the, I don't know, like emotional tools. Like she didn't have people she could talk to, or like a safe space she could go, or a way of like working through something like this. You know, she drank. And that was her escape. That was her solution. And ultimately it was what killed her.
Thank you, Danielle. That was a powerful section that you read. So a couple of questions. The next one is, so you mentioned your sister, Eileen, and Eileen is quite a prominent primary character in the memoir. Yeah. And one recurring tension throughout is your relationship with her, who others often compare unfavorably to your mother. Mm-hmm. So could you tell us a little bit about your sister and in what ways the two of you are different despite being raised in largely similar circumstances?
Yeah. Growing up, we were always really different. I'm quiet. I avoid conflict. I was always trying to do what I felt like was the right thing. I was trying to behave. I wanted to be good. I wanted to get good grades. And I was always trying to like make people happy. And Eileen growing up, she was a lot more volatile. Like she was angry. She would yell. If she was unhappy, you would hear about it. Whereas I would just like quietly sort of like put my head down and like carry on. And so growing up, I was like, you know, she's difficult. Like she's angry. Like we grew up the same way. Like, why can't you I don't know, like, stop being such a brat. Like, I would often call her that. There was like one letter I think I included in the memoir where I'm like writing about her. And I'm like, I just call her the brat. there was this like narrative in the family that she was a brat and she was spoiled. But it was, you know, as I started like working through this book and like working through my relationship, not only with my mother, but also with my sister, who then went on to, you know, at growing up, she, you know, so she started like drinking, experimenting with drugs in middle school. She was in and out of foster care. She was in and out of boot camp. She was in and out of jail a couple of times. And was like struggling with addiction, for so much of her life. And that idea that I had that it was because of who she was, stuck with me. And it really made it hard to maintain a relationship with her. And I shut her out of my life and much more easily than I did my dad or even my mom. And it wasn't until I started working on this book that I realized the ways in which we were actually treated quite differently growing up. And that it wasn't entirely her or her personality that made her act out. She was acting out in response to the way she was treated by our parents, by my grandmother. Like, she was the kicking dog. She was the one who took the brunt of frustrations. There's a scene I include in the book where my dad is drunk and he's gotten in a fight with one of his girlfriends, and she's like run off with her two kids. But as she was trying to leave, my dad had tried to grab the keys out of her hand, and my sister came up and like, I'm like standing like in the yard, just like, what is going on? Just sort of like quietly panicking. And my sister runs up. She's like she's in seventh grade, grabs my dad's arm and starts trying to like drag him away from this woman. It was like, let her go, let her go. It's like, you know, she just was like so brave. Like, I would never. But he turns around and he grabs her by the neck and he starts choking her in like the front yard. And after that, you know, Deb drives off. Nobody calls the cops. No one calls to check on my sister at all. We're sitting in the kitchen and he points at her and he's like, I would never do that to your sister. And it's like, to hear that as a child, what do you do with that information? Like, and so she just grew up feeling like she wasn't loved. And that was why she was acting out.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So another theme in the book, with Eileen, with your father, with your mother, is struggles with addiction and alcoholism. So you mentioned how your sister was experimenting with drugs and alcohol from an early age. Your father repeatedly, within the narrative, tries and fails to sober up. And as you mentioned earlier in the interview, your mother actually dies while trying to quit. Mm-hmm. So growing up, your grandmother told you when you were quite young, quote, you're an alcoholic, you just haven't had your first drink. So I'm wondering, what was your relationship to addiction growing up and as an adult? And how are you able to avoid the same patterns of alcohol and substance abuse?
Yeah, I think honestly, like, some of it was fear, like the fear that I mentioned earlier. We did grow up, we were baptized. We were raised Catholic. We went to Catholic school for a while when we were in Florida. We had like Irish Catholic nuns and like wore jumpsuits and everything. It was, and they were very strict. And I think because I avoid conflict, I had a really hard time in that kind of environment. And I felt like I'd be punished sort of like severely for things that didn't really make sense to me. And so I kind of always feared punishment or like judgment by God for a while. I went through a phase where I was really scared about like what things God might judge me for and why. And I asked for like a catechism for Christmas one year. Like I wanted a Bible for Christmas. Like it was pretty intense. And so I think some of it was fear. Some of it was like not wanting to disappoint my family, feeling like I had to be successful and I had to take care of everyone. And especially like seeing my sister from such a young age start going down the same path as my family, or feeling like she was, I felt even more the weight, sort of like the weight of expectation that I wouldn't. And that became a lot more complicated the older I got. And when I was in college, especially I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and had depression. And, at that point I was like on a couple of different medications that I was responding to really in a bad way. And when I would get manic, the only thing I found I could do at one point was just like drink a lot of, it was like vodka and cranberry juice, was the only thing I could drink. Because I think I'm allergic to beer, which also helps. I can't drink beer without feeling very sick, which might be psychological. It might be physical. I'm not sure. I think I do, you know, my family, I feel like I have this reputation in my family for being quite dark or for lingering on or thinking too much about things that I should put in the past or put behind me. But I think that what I have gained from that kind of like dark way of thinking, according to them, is that I have a lot of introspection. And so, you know, I was doing it. I knew what I was doing when I was doing it. I knew I was self-medicating. And for a while, I let myself get away with it, but I couldn't let myself get away with it for very long without really beating myself up. And so I think rather than alcohol and addiction, I think a lot of where I get my dopamine hits are from video games. And I've struggled with sort of like this video game addiction as an adult for a very long time. And it's like more acceptable. It destroys my life in like, it doesn't like destroy my life in some of the same ways. I don't think I've entirely escaped or avoided some of these patterns. Mm-hmm. I've still created a situation for myself in which I am isolated and escape from some of my problems. It's just that it's not quite a destructive way, or in quite the same destructive way. Mm-hmm.
So throughout Dogflowers, this is something I've been dying to ask you about. There's a strong, there's a very strong and prominent bird motif, which begins in childhood when you witness a yellow bird get eaten by a cat. And you write of that time, quote, "I couldn't understand why the bird had flown so close to danger." Later in life, you become a bird watcher. So I'm wondering, what are some of the varied significances of the many birds that appear in your memoir?
Yeah, thanks for this question. It was kind of intimidating. So I'm a faculty mentor at the Institute of American Indian Arts. And one of my students this semester really wanted to read my book. And I'm like, you should read it with someone else. But she really wanted to read it this semester. And so she had to write this craft paper about my book afterwards. And she actually wrote about the birds. And she tracked sort of like when they appeared and why they appeared and how they changed over the course of the whole book. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can't. It's really weird for someone to do that kind of craft analysis on your book. And you know, honestly, like she was bridging connections that I didn't understand quite so explicitly. So I think people give a lot of credit to Leah Altman, who answers, I think, this question of how are the birds working as a motif or as an image? You know, one of the things that she said was that it actually changes, and that early on, like those early birds are like these fragile, delicate things, and in a way, I am projecting myself into them. And so that very first little yellow bird, who did, like, you know, it was a parakeet I kept its little feathers. And later when I owned parakeets, I recognized the barring on them and the shape of them. And it was someone's pet that had escaped and was out living in Florida. And when it saw me and my sister playing in this field, it was like, oh, person, I'm like hungry, or like, you know, like I need help. And so it had flown down because it recognized like people, and it didn't recognize cats. And so before either my sister or I could like help it, this cat pounced and like ran under the house with it, like ran and under my house with it, or my dad's house. And you know, what Fran told me, what my stepmom told me in that moment was like, it's just like what cats do. Cause I had asked her like, why did it do that? But I had been asking about the bird, like why did the bird like put itself in danger? And part of the problem was it just didn't recognize danger. It hadn't been raised to recognize danger or dangerous situations. And growing up as a kid, it was much the same way for me. Like I was raised to normalize certain behaviors, certain kinds of relationships. Like I didn't understand what like a healthy, supportive, loving, familial relationship looked like from my own family members. And I was raised, to put myself in like dangerous positions or like emotionally like draining positions. And it's taken a long time for me to, and not only like recognize, relationships and people that are bad for me, especially romantic, like I've been in a lot of like bad romantic relationships, but then it's also been hard for me to like now not expect the worst from people. So, you know, like I'm married, I've been with my husband since 2018, or we got married, or anyway, we got married in 2018. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he'll say something or do something. And I think I've become like really good at recognizing patterns of behavior. And sometimes it works out for me and sometimes it doesn't. So he'll say something that like reminds you of my dad, or like feels like something my dad would have said. And I'm like, oh, so like, and I'll jump. I'll take it into like this really dark place. He's like, no, like that's not at all what I meant. And so it's this like learning and unlearning process for me as an adult. But as like the birds go, you know, like I had this bird, Barry, when I was in middle school, which is another bird I write about. And my dad had this like philosophy of like, if you love something, you have to let it go. It has to be free. And so he would like release my bird out, and I'm like, the bird's just gonna get eaten by a cat. It can't survive out there. And I gave my bird away because he wasn't safe in my home. And I wasn't safe in my home, but there was no one to give me away to. Like my grandma kept giving us back. It was crazy. But you know, as the book goes, like these wild birds that I'm encountering, like, That was actually, it's a place of peace that I found, like watching these birds live their little lives, like totally apart from like whatever chaotic thing is happening in my own. There are like these little pockets of tranquility mm-hmm. for me.
Yeah. I love that. So another huge theme in Dog Flowers, or a huge event or kind of like learning experience for you as the speaker is, so your mother is Navajo and you grew up largely disconnected in many ways to Navajo traditions and heritage and land. And after her death, you actually stay with your mother's family on the reservation, learn the language, learn the stories, take traditional weaving classes. So I'm curious about what it was like for you to reconnect with your mother's side of the family in this way.
Yeah. I mean, it was really, difficult, because, you know, going to my mother's home, meeting my mother's family, like there is this undeniable connection. Like my cousin's sister, my mom's sister's daughter, she reminded me so much of my sisters, and we like very naturally started acting like sisters to each other. Like it felt strange to meet this person for the first time in my whole life and to feel that kind of love and connection and desire to protect her and like keep her safe. It felt so strange to feel that so immediately with my cousin. And like meeting my aunts and my grandmas and my grandpas, like was I recognizing something of my mother? You know, like what about it felt so much like home and felt so much like family? And it's really hard to put that into words. But at the same time, I also felt very outside of those relationships and very outside of that experience. It's like I wasn't, when I was there, it didn't feel like I was totally there. I felt sort of outside myself watching it all happen. Because, you know, like Navajo is a really hard language to learn. And I recognize some of the sounds in it now, but I can't speak it. And I certainly am not conversational in it. And so when people would speak it around me, often I was like left out of those conversations, or even just like, you know, like little cultural references or like ways of preparing food or like the kind of seasoning people use or what kind of cheese, you know, like all of those little things I was having to pick up. And I'm also, you know, just in general, like not very comfortable in those domestic spaces. Like, I don't know how to cook. Like, you know, like there are a lot of things I feel like I'm not very good at. And so to move into that space as a woman and almost to feel like expected, like I could start contributing, I could start help making like this big memorial dinner for my mom. I was like, boy, just, you know, like I'm just like, okay, like I'll take the shells off of eggs. Like I'll peel some carrots. Like this is the extent of what I can do. And so I felt pulled in two very different directions there. Like one, like, oh, this is family. And two, boy, do I not know how to live inside this family. And I think if my, and there was a lot in the way, right? Like my aunt was like drinking. She was very sad. She was having a really hard time of it. It was hard to make space for or invite her totally into my life and to open myself up to potentially a dynamic that felt similar to the dynamic with my mother, like to open up myself to that kind of heartbreak. And I made a decision somewhere along the line that I just couldn't, like I couldn't do it. I had to take care of my sisters. And I couldn't make room for that kind of relationship again right now anyway.
So then how did your understanding of who your mother was change after spending time with her side of the family, with her sisters and cousins? And ultimately, what did this journey teach you maybe about yourself as your mother's daughter?
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I finally came to understand was the extent to which my mother was herself a caretaker. And that was a word that the priest, when we were having a conversation about her memorial service, the priest came to that, like, oh, she was a caretaker. Because I mentioned that she'd like taken care of one of her boyfriends through his cancer diagnosis and things like that. And it felt like sharp and funny and not funny in a way, because she had, you know, like it felt like she hadn't taken care of me. She hadn't taken care of my sisters, like my three other sisters, but she was like, and it's weird that when I made decisions about who to cut off, they're different from the decisions that my mother made. Her decision was that she was going to cut herself off from her daughters. And why she made that decision was one of the things that I began to understand. And the ways that in which she had overextended herself and our similarity in that way, you know, like I spent so much of my adult life trying to take care of my dad and trying to take care of some of these like I don't know, like men who are also children who were like depressed or like didn't know what to do with their lives or whatever. Like we've had a lot of those kinds of, I'm sure like people in general have been in a lot of those kinds of relationships. But like I started to recognize all the ways in which I was like engaging in these unhealthy romantic relationships that my mother had been engaging in her whole life, and how it was just an extension or a continuation of the ways in which we had been conditioned by our families. Like, you're a woman, you will take care of like these people because that is your job. That is like ultimately like your purpose in life. And she never escaped that. She never got out from under that. And, there was this man who knew my family very well. He basically, he wasn't in our family, but he like spent a lot of time in their home when he was younger. And he wrote me a couple of emails about my mom. But in them, he was like, you know, your mom, like she loved school. She loved studying. She loved reading. She wanted to get an education. She wanted all of these things. And to see, or to, you know, to have experienced how her life played out and all those things that she wanted that she didn't get to do, it helped me understand sort of some of those patterns that I had fallen into and the changes that I would have to make to do the things that I wanted to do, and also to like preserve my own sanity and health and well-being.
Mm-hmm. So I just have one last quick question for you, and that is, What are you most hoping that readers will come away from Dog Flowers understanding better about families, about who we are and where we come from?
Yeah. You know, I think especially for people who are growing up in families that are like mine, it can feel like we don't have a choice about who our family is and what our connection to them is. And it feels obvious now, like standing outside of it, that I didn't have to take, you know, like I didn't have to take care of my dad. I didn't have to keep letting him disrupt my life. And I could put boundaries between us in ways that I hadn't been taught to do. But when I was in it, it didn't feel like a choice. And I was told, you know, like, but like the things that I was told, the behaviors that were modeled, what I was raised to believe was important, all of those things made it feel like it wasn't a choice and that I was in it and that I was just going to have to figure out a way to make it work. I was going to figure out how to support my like middle-aged alcoholic father for the rest of my life, or the rest of his life, I should say. But it's a choice. And my grandmother, my dad's mom, enabled him. She enabled him his whole life. And there's a difference between care and compassion and enabling. And that's a line that I've had to learn how to walk. And so with my sister, you know, she is sober now. She's clean now. And we have a really, I'm going to say like great relationship, though. Like it's just getting better. You know, like we text each other pictures of our gardens. We like, she mailed me seeds to put in the ground this spring. And, you know, like, and it's so much better than it was, but we're still learning like how to talk to each other. But that kind of love, like between us, like it is work and it's worth it. And, you know, like, yeah, all of those things.
Well, wonderful. Thank you. That's great news about Eileen as well. Yeah. So Danielle, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for these thoughtful answers to the questions and for being with us here today.
Yeah, no, they were great questions. Thank you.
My name is Zoe Bossier, and you've been listening to an interview with Danielle Geller, author of Dog Flowers, a memoir, on New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thanks for listening.